As Don, our president, remarked at the very beginning, I've only just flown in yesterday afternoon from London, having gone there to give a conference on human resources, but also to do some other interesting activities. I said this to one of the drivers while I was in UK, and I like to sort of do new things as a monk, you know, to boldly go where no other monk has been before. If you know your Star Trek, that's what that Captain Kirk used to say when I used to watch that 30 years ago. Actually, to see other little things which go on in the Buddhist world, because when there is new experiences, there's always new insights and different ways of looking at things. And certainly if you come to a place like this, the last thing you really want is to listen to what you already know, to hear what you've heard before, because the whole point of growth is to be able to see things from a different perspective, to expand one's understanding of the world, and there, through one's expanded understanding, to see a little deeper, to overcome some of the questions and the problems which arise in our daily lives. And one of the invitations which I was very keen to accept while I was in the UK, because it was unique, I'd never done this before, was actually to go to the Ministry of Defence in UK to talk to soldiers and Air Force personnel and Navy personnel who were Buddhist. Because sometimes you wonder, and I've wondered for a long time, can you be a Buddhist and a soldier at the same time in a modern army which is involved in many dubious conflicts around the world? And how can you be a Buddhist? Because certainly when I was growing up, I thought that was the last thing which a Buddhist should do, to join an army. But I always want to question these things and never take my assumptions for granted. So there was a chaplaincy conference for Ministry of Defence personnel. I remember the last time which I was in UK being driven past one of the huge establishments which were protected by many layers of razor wire because of security concerns, and wondering whether that was a misnomer. They shouldn't really call it the Ministry of Defence, because it's more like the Ministry of Attack. But I wanted to go and see what was happening. And so because there were people who signed up as being Buddhists in the British Army, and because that there was a duty of care to such personnel, that the government had to organize spiritual care for those who signed up as Buddhist. So they have established a Buddhist chaplain, and the Buddhist chaplain wanted to have a Buddhist chaplaincy program on one weekend. And I happened to be in town at the time, so I was invited to one of the military establishments outside of Andover to talk to the Buddhists. When I went there and I told other people I was going there, of course that question was asked. Is that what in Buddhism we call right livelihood, to be a soldier? Because those of you who know your Buddhism know that the ethics and morality in Buddhism is so passive and non-harming. And part of the Eightfold Path is called right livelihood. In other words, if you have a livelihood which causes harm or hurt to other beings or to yourself, that's not considered beyond the path of Buddhism. So I always assumed that being a soldier was wrong livelihood. You're a bad Buddhist if you can be a Buddhist at all being a soldier. But then again, you know, the armies are sometimes useful in this world, if not essential. And the role of armies has been changing. At least it should have been changing, and much of their role is sometimes in peacekeeping. But more than that, when I went up to see the people who were soldiers, I was very impressed with their sincerity and their integrity. They were committed to being Buddhists. They respected its philosophy and the way of looking at the world. And they really wanted to be Buddhists. And so there was as much of a problem in their own trying to bring together their Buddhist practice and their Buddhist ideas with their career as a soldier. It was as much problem for them as it was for me, just trying to figure out where they were at and what they were doing. But it's their sincerity which really impressed me and made me think again. Is it wrong livelihood to be a soldier? Can you be a soldier and a good Buddhist at the same time? It reminded me of another sort of assumption which, you know, some Buddhists had a long time ago. Is it all right to be, say, a homosexual and be a Buddhist? And of course, not having been grown up with homosexuals or lesbians or transgender people, being a straight guy in London during my 60s, sometimes I didn't know until coming to Perth, you got to know, befriend and respect members of the gay and lesbian community. And there's nothing wrong with being gay, lesbian, homosexual, whatever, and being a good Buddhist. It's how you practice your sexual life makes you a good Buddhist or not such a good Buddhist. Perhaps it was the same with being a soldier. So I had to look more deeply into what it means by the ethics of Buddhism and go deeper into the idea of the law of karma to understand, if you are a soldier, are you making bad karma or good karma? And it's a whole investigation which is going to be the subject of this talk this evening. Even though you aren't soldiers yourself, and maybe you are, there's a few soldiers or military people in this talk this evening, there may be some listening on the internet, it's a fascinating question to get some bearing on. Because even if one is not in the military, that one does depend upon the military for one's security. We do have an Australian Army and Air Force and Navy, and they do offer some protection for our lifestyle. And maybe you may have a friend or a son or a father who's in the military. We just celebrated Anzac Day while I was overseas. Have you ever noticed that somehow in the military there is a sense of ethics, a sense of dignity, a sense of selflessness, which has always inspired me as a Buddhist monk? And something, there's something really respectable in the military. But then again, there's the killing and the bombing and the bullets, which sometimes is hard to accept as a Buddhist monk. But then again also, it's not just Australia which has an army. Every country has an army, even so-called Buddhist countries. I was in Sri Lanka in February, and Sri Lanka is a predominantly Buddhist country, and they have a strong army, and I'd imagine that most of the soldiers in that army are Buddhist and go to the temple. But they are fighting a war with the Tamil Tigers, and it's a very vicious war. I would actually say that it's not a Buddhist versus a Hindu war, because there are people of all religions on both sides. And I know, I was told, I didn't know this before, that the leader of the Tigers, Prabhakaran, is actually a Catholic, not a Tamil. It's nothing to do with religion, that war. But if you are a Buddhist, can you fight in that war? I was also having a conversation with someone a couple of weeks ago before I left to go to United Kingdom, that we often say that in Buddhism there's never a war fought in the name of Buddhism, and Buddhists don't go to the war. But then in the Second World War, the many Japanese called themselves Buddhists and fought. So where does this all lead us? We have questions to ask here. And the question has to come more deep than we've ever gone before. The Buddha actually did say that the karma is all about one's intentions. And those intentions have to be looked upon from two angles. Sometimes that even word intention and karma is not understood in its proper depth. When I studied the rules for monks, which is a very, very strict discipline, a very strict rules which we have to keep, it dawned upon me from how these rules worked that there is two halves to intention which one has to consider if one is going to find out whether something is ethical, allowable, appropriate or not. And those two halves are one's motive and one's goal. And later on, having discovered this, you know, in 2500 years Buddhist rule book, to find out this is very, very close to modern Western law. The motive is where one is coming from, and the goal is where one intends to reach. For example, you know, one may be coming from compassion, or one may be coming from fear, one may be coming from ill will, one may be coming from just stupidity. These are called one's motives. Where is one coming from? And the Buddha was very clear to say that it is the color of the karma, whether it's good or bad karma, wholesome or unwholesome, skillful or unskillful, all depends upon the motivation, where one is coming from. In other words, if one is really acting from compassion, from kindness, from selflessness, you know, from generosity, because one is coming from the right place, the pure place, however that pans out in one's actions of body or speech, or even if one's restrained from action, non-action, that is always going to be good, positive karma, because it comes from the right place. However, if one is coming from selfishness, you know, ill will, or whatever, that's always going to be bad karma, because it's coming from the bad place. So in other words, if you want to sort of make a donation, but just out of pride, just to show off, because you think that, you know, you are better than the person sitting next to you, then there's an element of bad karma there, because it's coming from the bad place. And the question now is, can you say do an act of killing coming from compassion? Is there a possibility that you can, because, you know, good karma is always what comes from a good place, a good motivation. Can there be a positive, wholesome motivation, sometimes to say for killing? Can one kill out of compassion? Selflessness, self-defense, putting a person out of their misery, or whatever. And the case which I quoted, which I think you may have heard here before, which changed many of the ways that I looked at the law of karma, was a case which occurred when I was visiting my family in England many years before, when I was staying with my mother, and there's only so much meditation you can talk about with your mother. Actually, don't even try it, because you'll never be able to teach your mother anything. Because she looked after you when you were so small. And that conditioning is so strong that anyone else can teach your mother, but not you. No matter how wise you are, how brilliant you are, or how enlightened you are, your mother is your mother, you are her son, she is the teacher, you're the disciple, and that's it. So I remember once sitting with my mother. She was watching the news on television, so I sat down and watched it with her. And that's when I saw a report on a fascinating situation which was happening at that time in a hospital in the south of Wales. Because there was a mother who was pregnant with twins. And the situation was that if that doctor did not intervene with certainty, the mother and both children would die. There would be three deaths. But if that doctor performed an abortion on one of those fetuses, then the other one would survive, and so would the mother, with 100% certainty. It was a fascinating situation. Should the doctor perform an abortion on one of the fetuses in the mother's womb, or should he just stand aside? And because the situation was so certain that if he did nothing, three would die. If he did something, one would die. To me, it was one of those very, very rare occasions when it seemed ethical for that doctor to perform the abortion. And when I've gone around different countries and I've asked people, Buddhists, sincere Buddhists, what they would do if they were the doctor, I think nearly everybody I've asked, 98% of Buddhists maybe, or 99%, would always say if that was them, that they would perform the abortion. Sometimes people object, they say they should do nothing, but certainly in Buddhism, in ethics, in common sense, if you have a duty there, doing nothing is an act of negligence. It is just as culpable if you actually performed an act to kill the whole three. To sit back and do nothing is no excuse. If you have an opportunity and a duty of care, doing nothing is the same as doing an act. It is still bad karma to do nothing when you could have done something. As obviously in modern law, if you just pass by somebody who is dying or needs some assistance by the side of the road, you just can't sort of stop and do nothing. You have your duties there. For example, when people ask me, you know, how about your rules of being a monk? You know that sometimes we're not allowed to touch ladies as a monk, and nuns are not allowed to touch the men. But I remember here in Perth many years ago, I carried a beautiful girl in my arms. Maybe she must have been about maybe 19 or 20. And I carried her in my arms, and she was dressed with makeup and perfume out for the night. And the situation was, I was travelling back from a talk one evening, and the car in front of us was involved in a collision. And so obviously we stopped, and I helped the injured out of the car. So she was covered with blood. And of course, whether she was a girl or a boy, young or old, whatever, I had a duty to help. And that duty was more important, as part, if you like, of the rules of discipline which I have. And I'm sure that anyone who's seen me would have actually criticized me more if I just stood aside and just let an injured person suffer more than she needed. There is something about the underlying rules of compassion and awareness which one should always bear in mind when making these ethical decisions. To doing nothing is no excuse if it's going to cause more harm. So in that case of a doctor who was faced with a decision, which in my terms was to kill one or to kill three, what was the most compassionate thing to do? In that case, you know, if that was me and I wasn't a monk, I would say that I would perform that abortion to save three lives. And it was rare because to save two lives rather than to allow three to die. It was a rare occasion because most of life we don't face those dilemmas. Most of life it's quite clear, but there are always these exceptions to the rules. And it's those exceptions to the rules is where the underlying principles of Buddhism have to come up. Those underlying principles are the karma, the sort of the color of that karma, whether it's going to be positive or negative, good or bad. It's all where one is coming from. What is one's motives? If it really is out of compassion and kindness, then it's going to be the right place to go, the right thing to do, because you're coming from the right place. Another example of that, which I've quoted here again, which I want to bring up because it puts these things in perspective. Sometimes one could think that's a carte blanche for just breaking all your precepts, for carrying ladies if you're a monk, or for doing these other things in ordinary circumstances. I'm talking about exceptional circumstances here, when, like as a monk, I'm allowed to carry a beautiful lady, or where as a doctor it seems appropriate to perform an abortion. This other case was concerns the Buddhist precept of lying. And it changed my opinion of lying once when a disciple from here, it was an English man who just happened to be in the Royal Navy, but he retired to Perth. He had a heart attack many years ago. He's a very devoted Buddhist, one of the earliest members of our Buddhist society. After his heart attack, they managed to get him to Walpurth in time to save his life, but he was on the edge. His arteries were clogged, and so he was put on the emergency list for a bypass operation, which was the usual procedure in those days before stents and balloons and stuff. So he was in one of the wards in Royal Perth Hospital, a ward with three other men, waiting for his time to have the bypass, but also waiting until his condition was strong enough to take that operation, because he just had a heart attack. So he was waiting for there many days, and I used to go and visit him. And you know what it's like being in a ward with other men or other women? You're there all day, 24 hours, and you must get to speak to these people, and you get friends with them. When I was in hospital once in Rockingham, just for 6 or 7 days, again in a ward with three other people, you really got friendly with these people, but unfortunately, when you're friendly with these people, you have some very stupid conversations. Because I remember a conversation we had in this ward, and we got round to the worst possible medical procedure. Many of these people have been in hospital before, you know, and some said it was one of these injections you have to find out how your kidneys are going, because they put a huge amount of radioactive material in your veins. Another one said, that's nothing, the barium meal, because it tastes awful, that's the worst. And I remember someone said, no, I've had all of those, the very, very worst is the barium enema, they said. And that's when one of the men in the corner went white. He said, I'm going to have that this afternoon. Stupid thing we do. But this was a ward in which everyone was having the same thing, bypass. And the fellow in the next bed was there first before this Buddhist guy. He had his bypass one afternoon. And it was that evening when his wife called me at the monastery in Serpentine. And she was very, very agitated. And the reason she called me, she said she'd just been to see her husband at the hospital. And the husband had asked how Jack was, the fellow who just had the bypass. And she said, he had a wonderful, successful operation, that he's now in the ICU recovery. And the truth of the matter is, she told me that Jack died. The operation wasn't successful. And she said that she lied to her husband. She said that was the first time in 30 years she told an untruth deliberately to her husband. She thought that if she had told the truth, the man in the next bed, who her husband befriended, who had the same operation her husband was going to face in 1 or 2 days' time, if she had told the truth that that guy had died, she thought her husband might have worried so much, would have been in so much fear, that that would lower his chances of surviving the operation. As it was, her husband came that close to dying. His operation was successful, but it was touch and go for many, many hours. He pulled through. So when she told me that she'd lied to her husband by telling her husband that the fellow hadn't died when he had, out of concern for her husband's safety, I told her in that situation, probably your lie was justified. Perhaps it was coming from wise compassion and concern. Maybe if you'd have told the truth, your husband may not have survived. And I think that many people can understand her situation, and many of you would probably do the same. But I mention that particular example to say that, okay, in some situations it's okay to lie, but only once every 30 years. In other words, it's a rare thing, it's an exceptional thing, but it's the exception which makes it important for us to understand how this karma thing all works and why it works. There's a whole thing there. You're coming out of compassion. You're coming out of some wisdom. You're trying to do the best for everybody. So how does that fit with a soldier in the front line? Most of the people which I met at this conference were actually in supporting positions of the army. There were dentists. There were accountants. I remember this monk who was at our monastery for 1 or 2 years. He told me that before he was a monk, he was a Gurkha. And those Gurkhas in the British Army were fearsome soldiers. So I was a bit concerned about having him in our monastery in case he misbehaved and I had to tell him off. You've got to be very careful who you tell off. But then he told me that his job in the British Army as a Gurkha was in the accounts department. So I thought, I don't need to be afraid of him. But of course, most people in such military are support staff, and many of them were dentists and accountants and other such things. So they don't really have that moral dilemma. The moral dilemma were for the people in the front line. And I was listening intently when one of these soldiers, who was a mature soldier, who had served in many, many campaigns, and who had been in front of the rifle, pulling the trigger, to listen to how he felt about what he'd done as now as a Buddhist. And how he felt, and I really respected this, because I have never fired, actually I did fire a gun in fun when I was in Guatemala, but I was a coconut tree, missed by miles. But I've never actually fired a gun or any weapon at a human being, or even an animal. So I don't know how it feels. I always feel it's presumptuous to judge other people when you don't realize the situation or the pressures they're in. But I was so interested to hear him say how he felt at the time and how he feels afterwards. And he always believed that what he was doing was justified at the time. That what he was doing was for the greater good. That it was out of compassion rather than out of any ill will. Now that's how he felt. That was clear from what he said, was how he justified that to himself. I don't know if I can believe him. So how do we actually know whether such actions are justified or not? And now we come to another part of Buddhism, which I've always found incredibly useful, to find out whether what we actually believe, what we see of our intentions, is really what's there or not, or whether we are deceiving ourselves. To see whether it really is possible to be a Buddhist soldier in the front line. It's very easy to convince ourselves that what we're doing is for the greater good. Because that's what, say, Islamic suicide bombers do. That's what terrorists do. Thinking blowing up the Twin Towers, yeah, it's going to cost them thousands of lives. But in the long run, it's going to be better for everybody. You know, the idea of like dropping a bomb in Hiroshima or Nagasaki, because that will save, you know, more American lives afterwards. That's a justification people give. And you've got to respect that that's how they think at the time, but is that really right thinking? Is that clear thinking? And because of this, I mentioned to the military here that whenever we make an ethical decision like this, in Buddhism we have 4 considerations we should really look at before we make a decision, to make sure that it is a fair decision. And those 4 things are to make sure we're not acting out of self-interest or self-desire, not acting out of ill will or hatred, not acting out of stupidity or delusion, and fourthly, not acting out of fear. These are the 4 things which the Buddha said you should consider very deeply before you make one of these actions, which could be bad karma or could be good karma. You've got to find out which one it is. Find out, are you really acting out of positive motives, or are you acting out of the negative motives? This is actually looking at those motives very clearly. Is one really acting out of self-interest? So, for example, that doctor who's performing the operation to actually abort one, or just to leave them alone and let 3 die, he had to really think, is there anything in me in this? For my career, for my reputation, for my financial advantage, if there's anything there which is in self-interest, it should be pushed aside, because that is not a consideration when you're making these tough decisions. That's even the case if you're at war. It's not about saving my life. Because I always remember what sort of Gandhi once said. He said in his famous comment, I can see 1,000 reasons for giving my life for a cause, but I can't see one reason for taking the life of another. You know, he was a selfless man, so he would actually put himself, his life on the line for his cause. But he said he could not see a reason for taking the life of another. So it should be that degree of selflessness in your decision-making process. Even sometimes if this was me, I'd hope as a monk, if it was either, you know, me or him, my attacker was about to kill me, and the only way I could prevent that was for killing him first, I'd expect myself, okay, you can kill me. And I'll take the bullet rather than give a bullet to you. That degree of selflessness is something which we build up, you know, as monks, and sacrificing ourselves, not being so concerned about ourselves. But self-interest should not be part of one's decision-making. Instead of self-interest, it shouldn't be just about the other. It should always be us, as I keep on saying here, about us, the common interest, rather than self-interest. And obviously we should be very careful never to act out of ill will, you know, really wanting to harm another person or to harm ourselves. All the decision-making should be coming from a sense of harmlessness, of really good will. Now this is a complicated one here, because sometimes we have to harm to help. There's an old Buddhist saying that if you've got a fishbone stuck in your throat, then you have to put your finger in that throat and pull that fishbone out, even though it hurts. It hurts in the moment, but the long-term benefit sort of is much, much better than that few moments of pain pulling out the fishbone. So as a Buddhist, doesn't mean we're sort of so soft and passive we never stand up and assert, you know, a stand for what is right. Even though it can be hurting another person, then we have to look at the bigger picture. It's the same when people tell me that they're running a company or they're running an office, and sometimes someone has to get fired. And they say they feel terrible about firing another person because that's really hurting them. I say that they should really consider not just that person, consider everybody involved, but the whole company, because if there is one person who's causing a huge amount of problems, then you should be compassionate to the other people who put up with them as well. That's what I've learned being an abbot of a monastery. Sometimes when you have a person come and stay at our monastery in Serpentine, they may have a lot of social and psychological problems even. And then, you know, I want to be kind and compassionate towards them, because I know just staying in a monastery in that very positive environment can really help them. They can really grow and become better human beings. But at what expense to all the other monks in the monastery? I remember once when we had an alcoholic come and stay with us, and he was going through detox in our monastery, which was, number one, very dangerous, because we didn't really have enough understanding about the medical effects of going through detox. But also, this was a character we really didn't know about. We didn't know whether he was going to be violent or create any problems at all. But at that time, I gave him the benefit of the doubt. But I had to really be concerned about all the other people in the monastery as well. And there are times when you say, well, no, I don't think we can cope, you know, with your problem, and have to ask the person to leave. That's not compassionate to the person, but it's compassionate to the group. So sometimes, you know, when you look at an action, it might be harming one person, but overall it's compassionate to the many. That's why sometimes you have to, when you're considering, am I acting out of ill will, you have to always see the bigger picture. You know, your main motive is for the greatest happiness of the greatest many. So be careful you're not acting out of ill will. And the hardest one to consider when you're making one of these ethical decisions is, have you got all the facts? In the case of that doctor performing that abortion, you know, he had the time and the expertise actually to see, you know, what his options were. You know, to ask, you know, other doctors, other specialists, to see whether there's any other alternative. You know, to see whether it really was true if he did let the the pregnancy go according to its natural course? You know, would the three people die? Was that certain, 100%? So we had to get all the information in. And sometimes that's the hardest one of all, because often one hasn't got the time and the luxury of the hours needed to make that decision. So one has to find out the best one possibly can, using, you know, everything one has to get all the facts. And I'm going to come back to that in a moment, sort of making sure one never acts out of delusion or stupidity. And the last thing is to make sure one never acts out of fear. And of those four considerations before making a decision, so understand that it really is going to be ethical, I always think that that's perhaps the most important, to make sure one never acts and makes his decisions out of fear. Because I know that in religions or philosophies which are dogmatic, one uses fear to say that if you don't keep your precepts, you're going to go to hell. And we describe what it's like at hell. You know, where you get boiled in oil. Whatever else happens in hell for you. So acting out of fear is never an option to have a sensible, ethical outcome. We have to remove fear. It is because of the problem of fear that we want to remove all dogma and even as law as well, because too often people have a decision to make and they're afraid of the legal consequences of that decision, and sometimes they make a wrong decision which is legal but which doesn't fit with what they think is compassionate. And of course I'm here going into the area of euthanasia. There are many doctors and nurses probably here today who have hastened a person's death. In other words, you know, committed an act of euthanasia. It's illegal. They did that out of compassion. And probably they did the right thing. Again, if you're a soldier at the front line, it's like being a nurse on the front line. Or a doctor, you have a patient there who is suffering. A patient, like one person once asked me, can you take me out the back and shoot me? Because they were suffering so much at the end with their cancers. How do you make those decisions? Make sure you're not acting out of self-interest. Maybe you might be the beneficiary of their will, and you are short of a few bob. That is no reason. There is no reason sort of to go down that line. It should be selfless and say not ill will. And it has to be informed, not out of stupidity. You really do know what the options are and the likelihood of, you know, recovery, or the likelihood of more pain, or the likelihood of more distress. And also no fear. And that's one of the problems I have with our legal system, because the fear comes up because of the restrictions of the law. And I think that's a place where law should not go, because it just creates the fear which skews the decision making. And sometimes decisions, bad decisions, are made out of fear. And sometimes that when I hear of cases where people have made a decision which feels right to them in spite of the fear of the consequences, and I really applaud such people and think they're such strong, good examples to us all. And the one which comes up, and the one which I quoted at this MOD conference, because this was the military, I quoted that soldier in the Vietnam War who was the only one of a troop of soldiers to refuse the order to go in to a village in Vietnam, kill every man, woman and child. That was the famous My Lai massacre. Someone told me here that a documentary had been made of that massacre 25 years afterwards. For those not old enough to remember that, during the Vietnam War, I think it must have been about 68, could have been later, I'm not sure, the US, a troop of US soldiers led by Lieutenant Calley, had the orders to go into a village which was supposed to be infiltrated by the enemy and kill every man, woman, and child without exception in that village. Eventually, a journalist found out what had happened, and it became a national scandal. Lieutenant Kelly was court-martialed, put in jail, and later pardoned by President Nixon. But this enterprising documentary traced as many of those soldiers as they could find to actually to investigate how they felt 25 years on. And that could have been 35 years on, I'm not sure, because it was a recent documentary, but it was a long time after the event. And it seemed that all of those soldiers who followed the orders and killed men, women, and children, all of them had huge social, psychological, personal problems. None of them had what you might call a happy, contented, successful life. They were alcoholics or dependent upon drugs, alone, with no family. Obviously, they could not stand themselves. However, there was always an exception. That exception was an Afro-American soldier. He was the only one who refused the order. Now, refusing an order at war was understood to mean 3 or 4 years in military jail. If you ever heard of the military jails in the United States, well, let alone the military jails, the ordinary prisons in the United States are far worse than anything they have in Australia. And far worse than that still is the military prisons. So, this Afro-American soldier who joined the military to get out of the ghettos and to have a future outside of being in a gang or being a criminal. For many, it was the only way out. He joined the military. He had very limited education, apparently. But when the order was given, go into that town and shoot everybody, without exception, including little children, he refused, knowing that the consequences were going to be 4 years in jail, in a military jail. He took that, but now, so many years on, he's the only one of those soldiers who has a good life, who's happy, content. You can understand why. He was a person who disregarded the fear of the consequences. He never made a decision out of fear. And that way, his decision was ethically good. And the result of that, good karma, yeah, 4 years in jail, but I don't know how many other years, 20, 30, 40 years of a happy life. It was worth it. People like that you can admire, who will not give way to fear, will not have any self-interest, who know the ethical good and the ethical bad, because they know it comes from inside. It's not compassionate. It's not good. People should know that. Sometimes, though, they disregard those feelings out of those four things, self-interest, ill-will, delusion, and fear. That's the reason why people make wrong ethical decisions. So before we make those decisions, even if it's the shoulder, to shoot or not to shoot, to abort or not to abort, we should follow those four ethical guides. Are we acting out of self-interest? Are we acting out of ill will? Is it delusive? Are we acting out of fear? If we can tick them off, we're not acting out of any of those. The chances are, huge chances are, you're making good karma. It's coming from the right place. It's compassionate, no matter what that act or that speech is. Going back to delusion that I did mention earlier about the vet, or putting someone out of their misery, or putting the kangaroo out of their misery when you hit them on the side of the road. And of course, as you all know, you probably heard here before, in most cases you're not putting the animal out of their misery, you're putting the animal out of your misery, simply because you can't stand to see something suffer. But the delusion part of this ethical problem of euthanasia or taking an animal to the vet and asking it to be put down. You may have heard me answer that question here in a very useful way. That if ever that happens to you, that, you know, it's your animal and the vet tells you, I have to put that animal down. Or, you know, if you happen to be a vet and you have a dog or a cat there which is very sick and you're considering sort of killing that animal, what should you do? Again, that's one of these ethical problems. Out of compassion and kindness, you see an animal suffer and you don't want anything to suffer. But then again, your precepts sometimes say that you shouldn't kill. What should you do? And the answer to this question, which, you know, I've been giving for a long time now, is very powerful and is an indicator of how to solve these problems. And the answer is very simple in its formulation, but very deep in its meaning. If that is a dog or a cat, and they're very, very sick, and you are responsible for them either as the vet or the owner, ask the dog. Ask the cat if they've had enough and they want to die. It's a very simple question. And obviously that those people who have cats and dogs, or who are sensitive enough as a vet, you know that you can communicate with your animals. Just like your animals can communicate with you. Not on the verbal level. And you won't even call it a psychic level. Subverbal. You know the animal. You love the animal. And sometimes you just need to look at it and ask that question. The most important thing is to ask the question. And then you'll get an answer. Sometimes that cat or that dog has had enough pain. And they can't stand anymore. In that case, it's the cat's decision. They want to go. You may even argue then, you're not killing the cat or the dog. It's the cat's decision. You've just listened and interpreted it with a clear mind. But sometimes, no matter what that cat or that dog looks like, you look at it and it says, no, it's not ready to go. It doesn't want to go. And it should be, you know, the cat's call. And that's a practical way, and it does work. There's one of the old members of our Buddhist society, or I shouldn't say the word old, long-standing members of our Buddhist society, who came to see me a few months ago and said that's what happened with her dog. The dog was very, very sick with a cancer. She took it to a vet. The vet said it has to be put down. They're keeping it alive. You're just not being compassionate, not being caring. You can't do that to any animal to cause it to torture, to be tortured so much by the cancer. But she took the dog aside and just asked it, do you want to go? Are you ready to die? And she heard very clearly, you know, in her heart. She felt it. And each one of you is intuitive enough to do this. If it's your dog, your cat, she heard, no, I'm not ready. I don't want to die. So she refused the vet's advice and took the dog home. And the reason why this is a classic story was because the dog made a full recovery. And she was so pleased because even the vet was completely bamboozled by that. It shouldn't have happened. But the dog fully recovered. So it's a wonderful thing to ask the cat or ask the dog. And then please know that you are not, if you like, killing the dog. It's the dog's call. The dog wants to go, even if you're the vet. You see here, that takes away a lot of the moral problem, the ethical problem of this. And it's the same if you happen to be in that situation where you are the next of kin, and it may be, say, your mother is in a coma, and the doctor said, I need your permission to turn off the machine. What would you do? Of course, that's such a difficult decision to make, because even though your mum or your dad is in a coma, it doesn't mean they're dead, and people sometimes come out of coma. When the doctors are just so surprised, that should not happen, but it does. And many of you know that I often go to Singapore, and the president of that Buddhist fellowship, Angie, her auntie was in such a situation. And I heard her talk about what happened. She was in a coma for many days. You know, she survived that coma, but she told the story of what it was like to be in a coma and come out. It was a very, very rare and interesting story. But she was in, she called it the very, very dark place for don't know how long. And what brought her out was the sound, what she thought was temple bells tinkling. She was a Buddhist. And I noticed from deep meditation, its sound is the last of the senses, the five senses of seeing, hearing, smell, taste and touch, which disappears when you go in deep meditation. It's the first which comes up again afterwards. In a coma, you won't see, smell, taste, even touch goes first of all. The first thing to turn on again afterwards is sound. So if you have got anyone in a coma, please talk to them. If any sense is working, it's sound much more than physical touch. So that's what she heard. She heard a sound, and that brought her back into being alert in her body. But like many people in a coma who get to this stage of consciousness, they can hear and feel and even see, she was unable to communicate back. She couldn't move any of her limbs. She couldn't even move her eyelids, certainly not speak. And she was there in this body which she could not move, perfectly aware, listening to the doctor describe her situation to her sons. And the doctor said it was hopeless. There was no possibility of any cure. She would be in this coma like this for months, with no possibility of coming into full consciousness again. So the doctor was asking, shall we turn off the life support? And she was hearing this, and she couldn't say, I'm here, don't do it. And being a Chinese family, all the other children passed the buck to the eldest son. It's your decision. He said, you can't do this, it's our tradition. So the eldest son was there for this decision. I remember this auntie telling me that she willed her son to say, don't turn off the machines. There is communication there, even mind to mind. That happens. And the son said, keep her going for another day. And that's all she needed. Within those 24 hours, she started to move her limbs, just slightly, but enough to show the doctors that she was recovering. And from that she made a full recovery. And you would not believe that she was had been in a coma, been walking and speaking like a normal person of her age. That happens. And that's one case of it happening. So what should you do if someone was in that situation? Ask the person. They may be in a coma. But you just ask the question and you listen. You'll be able to feel whether there's someone there or not. Sometimes you do that. There's no one there, they're gone. In which case, when you tell the doctor to turn off the machines, you're not kidding anybody. They're already gone. It's just a machine of a body kept going by another machine. Life is gone. Other times you ask that question, you feel, no, you can't do this. That means the life is still there. Keep it going. When you ask the question, you get these wonderful answers. A lot of the problem is we never ask the right question, which is why we're not acting out of wisdom, we're acting out of delusion. So these are ways we can actually face the problem here. This difficult ethical problem. And as one of the soldiers told me, what's the difference between me on the front line and a vet who's putting down animals and cats, who there's some compassionate reason for them to die? And of course, the vet would ask the question whether the person wanted to die or not. Soldiers never ask that question. Which is why it is so difficult to be a soldier and, you know, to be a compassionate, kind person. The very ethos, you've got orders to kill. And if you don't keep those orders, you get into big trouble. And sometimes, like that soldier, it's probably better not to keep those orders. I remember Ajahn Chah's advice. When people were drafted into the army in Thailand, and some of them were devout Buddhists, and they wanted to go AWOL or just, you know, hide and not actually join up, but it was conscription. And his advice was, no, no, you have your duty, you have to join. And he told them to train really, really well, especially on the firing range, so they were accurate shooters, so that if they were in a conflict, they could always aim successfully over their enemy's heads. Make sure you miss, he was saying. But that's the easy case. In the case of the soldier joins up, and they are in that situation, and they do pull the trigger and kill, it may be ethically wrong, but it's also ethically wrong of me to actually to judge them, to condemn them, to not forgive and love them, because it's such a difficult situation which we are in. It's the same when a person makes the wrong call when they're considering an abortion, or when they're considering putting down their dog, when they're considering turning off the machine of their loved one in the hospital, or when they're a nurse or a doctor looking after people. If they do make a wrong call, they do make a mistake. If they really considered it carefully, and they really thought they were not acting out of self-interest, and most soldiers, they don't act out of self-interest. They try and stop the ill will business, but sometimes it is that delusion, and certainly the fear. If they are in such situations, please show some compassion and forgiveness. People do get themselves in difficult situations in life. And girls get themselves pregnant. We do have dogs and cats which we love, but they do get really sick. We've only got a certain amount of resources and money to look after the people who are in a coma. These are tough decisions to make. And a lot of time, as one of our monks pointed out, when we talk about karma, sometimes you can't even say it's good or bad. You say it's good and bad. It's a mixture of karma. It's what's called black and white karma. And as long as it's done with consideration, with what you think is compassion, even if you do make mistake, it's not that bad karma. The worst karma is, you know, when it's not considered, it really is out of ill will, out of selfish desire, not seeing the full picture. And that's the sort of soldiers we don't want in any army. The ones who have a sense of ethics, even if I don't agree completely with their ethics, who do have a sense of discipline, who do have a sense of restraint, at least if they do make the wrong decision, it's black and white karma. They really think they're doing the right thing, but maybe they may be deluded. And as such, the outcome of that won't be that bad. The result of people who perform black and white karma, very many of them get reborn in the human realm again, have another chance. It's not that bad. So we try and keep it in perspective. So this talk, which I've gone over time now, I'm going to open up for questions now, is an investigation into the karmic effect of killing, the moral consequences of this, and actually how we can make this investigation to find out if what we're doing is good or what we're doing is bad. It's not such a simple question. When I went into that MOD, I really thought being a soldier was bad. Now I realize that's just too simplistic. One has to sort of go deeper. When one goes deeper, one can also answer the questions with things like euthanasia, abortions, and taking your dog or cat to the vet. Get some deeper understanding. To remember, it's whether you're coming from compassion, good motivations, that is imperative. And to make sure you're coming from those positive motivations, go through those four checks. No self-interest, no ill will, no delusion or stupidity, no fear. And if you can actually check those things off, Now I think you can be pretty sure the likelihood is you're making a good decision. In the end, it's your call. You have to make that decision, or if it's your cat or dog's call, or it's the person in the coma's call. In most situations, that's what you have to do. If it's your call, make sure you make a wise decision. And even if it's a wrong decision, you won't be criticized. By making mistakes is often how we learn. Being afraid to make mistakes is how we keep in the delusion for age after age after age. We learn from mistakes. Okay, that's the talk tonight. Investigation into the ethics of murder. Okay, has anyone got any comments or questions about what I've said this evening? Yes. Oh, yes, yes. Okay, how you forgive a person. You're talking about, you asked a question about the person, I think, in Virginia Tech University who killed 32 people, I think it was. How can you, as including himself, and how can you forgive such a person? The first stage of forgiveness is always seeing something more than that crime. To see a bigger picture than that massacre. First way of forgiving anybody is to see more than that terrible, hurtful, cruel act which they performed. To see where they came from, what they did as a young man, as a student, because there's more to their life than one day. I've often said when I've gone travelling that in all the prisons which I visited, and I visited quite a few both here and overseas, I've never seen a criminal yet in my life. There's no such thing as a criminal. There are only people who have done crimes. There's no such thing as a rapist. There's people who've done those terrible rapes. There's no such thing as a terrorist. There's a person who does terrorist acts. Now, that may seem simplistic, but you can see that when somebody does this huge, enormous amount of harm in the community, that's all we focus on, to the exclusion of everything else, which is why we can't forgive. When you see what else they did, there is an opportunity for forgiveness. We realize they're not a criminal, they're a person who's done a crime. They're not an assassin, they're people who've done assassinations. They're not a murderer, they're a person who's done murder 32 times. Seeing the bigger person is a way we can see there's a reason to forgive. There's something to forgive. There are more than those terrible acts. If you can understand that, you can understand how the enemies which we have from time to time, when people have hurt us, cheated us, let us down, why do we make enemies of them? Why can't we forgive? Because we just focus on the hurt which they've given us, the pain which they've created. We can't see anything more than that. That's why they don't deserve to be forgiven. See the bigger picture. Some of these so-called criminals I've seen and murderers are such kind and wonderful people. It's strange. When you go into a prison, you see this person who's a notorious criminal. Perhaps the most notorious criminal I've ever seen is Ronnie Cray, one of the Cray twins in England. Oh, he shook your hand and was just really this nice, charming fellow. And I was with this other monk and he said, I want to get a few quid, I'll give a donation to your monastery. You see the bigger picture. If you see the bigger picture, then there can be forgiveness. I don't know, I did see in the aircraft coming over, there was something in a Time magazine. I only looked over my shoulder, the person sitting next to me was reading all about this fellow, his history and everything. I'm sure it's everything about the fellow which was bad and terrible and horrible. I probably never mentioned some of the wonderful things which he did, some social service he did as a kid or something, or how much he loved his mum and cared for his sisters. If we can only see the bigger picture, then forgiveness becomes possible. That's always the first step in forgiveness, to see what else they did, other than those horrendous acts. Does that make sense? Crime. Yeah. So it's very challenging to sort of open with open arms a person who's done such crimes. Of course, it's very difficult to do. But this is, I said, the first step of forgiveness. Forgiveness is not forgetting or ignoring the problem. Forgiveness is like allowing a way out of the pain and the hurt. The first step of forgiveness is to see the bigger picture, to see the positive sides in that person. And the second part of the whole process is the rehabilitation and making amends. There must be some making amends for the terrible things which they did. And I don't mean by punishment. I mean some sort of service. Something they can do for others. One of the inspiring stories which I came across when I was in San Francisco about 15, 16 months ago, there was a young man, I forget what his name was, he was in San Quentin jail awaiting execution. And he was a founder of one of the big street gangs in San Francisco called the Crips. He had murdered several people. He was caught, sentenced, and was about to be executed. But there was a big campaign in San Francisco to commute the sentence to life imprisonment, because this young man had written many books and was counseling a huge number of young people out of those gangs because of his experience being a gang leader on the streets of San Francisco, being a really bad guy, having understood, if you like, the error of his ways. He was using his experience to take many other sort of young kids away from those streets. And he was so effective. A huge campaign was being organized to try and ask the then governor, still governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, to please don't kill this guy, he's too valuable. He's actually helping where other people just cannot help. Unfortunately, Arnie Schwarzenegger thought that forgiveness was a girly thing, and he signed a death warrant. That's what they were quoting in the papers. And it's a terrible thing, these macho Americans at the time. But you know, that was one case where there was a positive angle to forgiveness. You know, obviously, that had to have some keep in jail, but he could actually do something. So why kill someone who's actually helping? And maybe a person who has committed such a horrendous sin, maybe in the future their task, their job, is actually to make sure no one else does that. To get a positive outcome from a negative experience. But unless we do forgive, we will always be in fear. And we'll be imprisoned, by the memory of that event. Forgiveness is the first stage. So the first stage of forgiveness is seeing the bigger picture. When we get to the final stage of forgiveness, only then we're free. Why be imprisoned by that? Why is everyone afraid? So forgiveness frees one from fear. So does that sort of answer your question? It starts to.
Yes.
Yes, you're saying for the sake of the video here that you're reminded of the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, who spoke for many of the boat people who escaped that country after the Vietnam War, and on the way to freedom were accosted by Thai pirates and raped and robbed of all their money. And instead of asking for anger to those Thai pirates and fishermen who performed such horrendous deeds to helpless, vulnerable people, he said to empathize as a way of forgiving, letting go. But it's true, until one forgives, one is always being raped again. Until one lets go, one is always in that situation again, 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 again. Every time you hate, you remember the cause of that terrible act, the cause of that hate. You're reliving the trauma once again. Only through forgiveness, through letting go, can we move on and be free. Okay, so, sorry about this no jokes this evening, but that's a serious talk, and I hopefully that you've all enjoyed it. Thank you for that question. We've gone on a bit long this evening. So now I have the final word from our president. And if you're still sitting there, if your knees are killing you, then please don't murder them. Okay, some. Okay, society sort of needs to protect itself, was the question just asked, and doesn't, if someone has done some terrible, terrible act, how does society protect itself? I think was the question. I've added a little bit there. And of course, like, forgiveness does not mean ignoring. It does not mean, okay, the person has killed 32 people, oh, never mind, guy, just don't do it again. And off you go back into society. Obviously, that's not a wise way of going about things. That there has to be protection in the same way that if a person has got bird flu, they have to be taken out of the community and protected for the while that they are still infectious for the safety of the community. But if we put someone in quarantine, we don't look upon that as a punishment. We look upon that as a compassionate, caring thing to do. So if you look upon, like, imprisonment as quarantine of a person who has a social illness or a psychological disease, I think that's a far more positive way of looking at taking the person out of society for the protection of others and for their protection. And who knows, perhaps, I've suggested this a few times, the sentence should be indeterminate in the same way that you stay in hospital until they are not infectious anymore, until the disease is over, no matter how long that takes.
Arahant Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Sovakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sovakasango Sanghang Namami.